Hello and welcome to We Are History. I'm John O'Farrell.
I'm Angela Barnes.
And what are we talking about today, Angela?
We are talking about the miners' strike, John.
That, oh my God.
I know, ripe for comedy.
Even funnier than the Spanish Civil War.
That's what they say about it.
Oh God, well, this is one of those stories where I talk about all the things I was doing and you're going, I was seven.
I was seven. Or was it? I had my seventh birthday in the middle of it. So I think I was six when it, when did it start? 84.
March 84, yeah.
Yeah, so I turned seven in November 84. No, I didn't. That's a lie. I turned eight in November 84.
Okay.
We're all right.
Oh, so you are much, that makes a huge
So I was quite
difference.
Mature.
Well, I was an angry young sort of student stroke graduate. So, you know, I felt very passionate about these miners with whom I had a huge affinity as an English and drama graduate from Exeter.
Oh, at the coal face of drama.
If I could have done a mime in my black leg warmers to support them, I would have done.
I'm sure they would have appreciated it, John.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point about this is all that time we're going, these are real jobs, these are proper jobs. This is, you know, the dignity of labour. And people are like, would you be a miner? Oh, goodness, no, no. I would get a job in the media somewhere. So anyway, that's a bit of background.
Yes.
A bit of background on the miners' strike. Britain, you know, had once been sort of almost totally dependent on coal for its energy needs. There were 1,000 pits after World War One, something like 1.2 million miners, I think, which declined sort of gradually over the 20th century. The pits were nationalised by the Labour government in the 40s. The National Coal Board became a sort of nationalised industry. But the miners always had a sort of heroic and sort of symbolic place in the Labour movement.
Yeah, being a big union and a big workforce, I guess that's...
Yeah, and a very politicised union,
thing.
I think.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like call centre workers today. They had banners, they had brass bands, they had identity. The streets of the Northeast were named after Lenin and Marx and things. They, you know, they were a highly politicised workforce. In the 70s, there were a couple of coal strikes, which sort of, I think, is sets the scene for the miners' strike of 1984. The 1972 coal strike, Edward Heath's Conservative government, he had to back down. There was a famous incident at Saltley Coatworks when Arthur Scargill, who then was only the head of the Yorkshire miners, he had organised a mass picket which closed down the coatworks. And he said to the policeman, give me your megaphone and I will tell the flying pickets to disperse. And the policeman went, oh, okay then.
All right. So oh, thanks.
He gave Arthur Scargill his megaphone. And Arthur Scargill went, this victory for the working classes proves that the ruling classes will never again be defeated by mass labour. And the policeman said, can I have my megaphone back now? And the fascist police running capitalist pig dogs.
Thank God that wasn't in America. Can I borrow your gun?
Yes,
could have had a whole different outcome.
Can you imagine that policeman in his boss's office on a Monday morning? So you gave Arthur Scargill your megaphone. He said he was going to get them to disperse.
Was he now?
When he was organising that mass picket, he rung up the other regional miners' leaders, and he rang up Di Griffiths, who was the leader of the miners in Wales.
You surprised
Di
me.
Di Griffiths. I know. In let me just check my notes. In Wales.
Wales.
And Di Griffiths said, oh, sorry, no, I got it wrong. It was Di Francis. Di Griffiths is my old teacher at school. He was my rugby teacher at school.
Well, hardly sounds Di Welsh Francis. At all, Di Francis. Are you sure he was Welsh?
And Arthur Scargill, Di Francis said, but when do you want this mass picket, Arthur? And Scargill went, tomorrow. Francis was like, but Arthur, tomorrow, Wales are playing Scotland at Cardiff Arms Park. And Scargill went, but Di, tomorrow, the ruling class are playing the working class at Saltley Coatworks. that was how he saw it.
He wasn't one for understatement on this, was he, Arthur Scargill?
No.
He liked a bit of good old-fashioned rhetoric.
Indeed. And I suppose, you know, he's the major figure of the miners' strike of 1984. By the time the strike came round in 84, he was the leader of the National Union of Miners, not just of Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. And he would be a major factor in the way it played out, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, yeah.
Thatcher had been in that Heath government that had been beaten twice by the miners.
And they were sore about that, right? They were.
So Ted Heath, after, the miners' strike in 74, we had a three-day week. We had lights going out. We had television ending early. You really felt
Gosh.
It. You know, I remember as a 12-year-old kid eating dinner over candlelight and,
wow.
There being no telly after 10 o'clock, I think it was, or 10:30. Ted Heath went to the country and said he held a general election saying, who runs Britain, the government or the miners? And the voters went, I think we'll go with the miners.
Yeah. Hang on, do we want jobs or do we not want jobs? Let me think about that.
So he lost two elections in 1974, poor Ted Heath. Mm. And he was out, Thatcher was in, and she thought, well, I'm not going to fall for that one.
Yeah. And so Thatcher now is leader of the opposition.
She's now leader of the opposition, Maggie Thatcher, the milk snatcher.
Yeah.
And they start cooking a plan for how it would play out and how they would have to win an extended coal strike.
Mm-hmm. So she's determined this is never going to happen again, right? They are not going to lose.
Do you want to talk a bit about the Ridley plan?
Well, the Ridley plan, so that was Nicholas Ridley. Who came up with this plan, and I've got notes on it somewhere, but they are not in front of me.
You threw that on me.
Was,
really. It's all the things that actually did come to pass. But what's fascinating about this is it was leaked or published, I think, quite openly in The Economist in 1978. But it involved importing huge amounts of coal and building up huge coal stocks, supplying the police with riot gear in all the different provinces.
That's quite a signifier that something's going on, isn't it? It's like, what's that? You're sending riot gear across the country. What?
Yeah, why does the Isle of Wight police need riot gear? Anticipated problems down at the bowling green this afternoon. And they passed anti-union laws. They had some anti-union laws about secondary picketing that they would push through when they
built up the coal stocks, didn't they, to make sure that
building
up
the coal stocks.
Yeah,
and they, building up, having a national police command center. These are all things that would mean that the government was much better prepared for the strike when it came, which it did in Thatcher's second term.
Yeah,
March 1984 was a bad time for the strike when it came around. Thatcher had won a landslide victory in the summer of 83. She'd seen off the Argentinian Navy. She'd seen off Galtieri. She'd won a landslide victory, and now was the time to see off the greatest bogey figure for the Conservative government, the unions.
Yeah.
And the most symbolic and powerful union of all, I think would be fair to say, was perceived to be the National Union of Mine Workers. It was also a bad time for the miners to have a strike because and, I'll probably make some enemies here in the former pit villages of Yorkshire, but I'd say because Scargill was the leader of the NUM. He was not a man to build alliances.
He wasn't one for soft negotiation, was he? He wasn't one for give and take.
No.
Yeah.
He was an out-and-out Stalinist, I'd say, a revolutionary. And he talked about the miners' strike in terms of overthrowing the government. When it was put to him that the government had been re-elected with a large majority the year before, he said he didn't accept the validity of the Conservative government and that extra parliamentary action, including this strike, was part of overthrowing the capitalist.
He wanted class war, right? That's what he wanted.
Yeah, he was a class warrior, I suppose, it's fair to say. The thing I will say, he was right about how extensive the government plans were to decimate the coal industry. Everyone thought he was exaggerating when he said they were going to close all these pits and put all these miners out of work. And in fact, the government ended up going further than even Scargill had feared. March 1984, the government had put Ian McGregor, who was in charge of the NCB.
That's the National Coal Board, in case anyone didn't know.
Yes, that's right. National Coal Board. Ian McGregor had been in charge of British Steel.
Yeah.
He'd sacked a lot of people there, won a strike there. And Thatcher thought he was a good person to do the same thing with the miners. Mm-hmm. But they announced the closure of Cortonwood in Yorkshire. That was a pit that they said was losing a lot of money. That was the trigger for a strike. The end of the winter, which is the worst time to start a strike, of course, with coal stocks high and the government secure.
See, it's hard to get, public sympathy when they're not feeling the pinch themselves, right?
Also, you don't have any leverage if people aren't using heating and lighting as much as they would be in the middle of January, then you'd have to wait till the following winter for coal stocks to run down.
Yeah, they've implemented the Ridley plan, so stocks are high.
Yep. And suddenly Scargill called out the Yorkshire miners and called on other regional miners' leaders to do the same. So that's one thing it's worth saying. This wasn't a national coal strike. It was all the different regions going on strike at the same time. There was no national ballot. And that was the thing that really divided the left, I suppose. The miners themselves and the union movement and the supporters of the miners. So in Nottinghamshire, where they did have a vote, they voted 3-1 not to strike. And so they felt they had a mandate to keep working through the strike. In many other areas, the strike was solid, and people would say, you know, no man has the right to vote another man out of his job. But Scargill, I think, wasn't confident that he could win a national ballot, so he just called on all miners to go on strike across the country. And so Kent, South Wales, Scotland, Yorkshire, the strike was solid. In areas like Leicestershire, Derbyshire, Nottinghamshire, it's less solid. And that created some of the division.
And this lack of national ballot sort of was their downfall in the end, wasn't it, in a way? Or it was certainly the stick that could be used to beat them.
Very much so. And it was, that was the way that the government got the courts to declare the strike illegal, that the Labour Party were less comfortable supporting Scargill. If it had been a democratically, nationally supported strike, then they would have been within their rights to say, why are you going to work? But if Nottinghamshire had voted to go to work, then it was very hard to say you have no right to work to save your job when others are losing theirs.
Yeah.
So very quickly, the country had 80% of miners out on strike. Yeah. Scargill's tactic was to send flying pickets to...
Not the musical group.
Not the musical group singing, you know, Only You. I suppose they were named after the syndrome of the flying pickets.
It would be a hell of a coincidence if it they would. Hadn't been, considering they had hits around that time.
They sent flying pickets to places like Leicestershire, Derbyshire, Nottinghamshire to try and blockade the pits where miners were still working.
So flying pickets, for anyone who doesn't know, are just people picketing not at the place where they work or don't
exactly.
work.
Exactly. So, people travelling to try and, you know, a gentle word would be say to lobby people driving into work. I mean, the reality was they were held back by rows of riot police as they shouted scab. It is a constitutional right that a worker should be able to talk to another worker on the way into his workplace to persuade him that he might support fellow workers on strike. Of course, the reality and the passions involved meant that, you know, this was a very volatile situation and often became quite ugly. One thing I should say about all of this is that this wasn't a strike for more money or for better working conditions or for lower hours. This was a strike to safeguard miners' jobs and to save communities.
And like you say, we're talking about 1.2 million jobs. This is...
Actually, no, not by... I don't think
not that many.
1984. I think that was what it was like after
the war.
Between the wars. But we are talking about hundreds of thousands of workers.
Yeah, and whole communities.
Living whole communities where... the pit was everything. The pit was the reason the village was built. The pit was the reason the shop was there. The school was there. Miners had been persuaded to buy their own homes in the pit villages in the way that people had been encouraged to buy their council homes.
In the right to buy of 1980?
Yeah, in that sort of culture of right to buy. Some, this was some of them. But I mean, with their whole community being destroyed and left without a purpose, these homes would have been useless as well.
So you've basically got the situation where it's like, hey, you could buy your council house in 1980 and then 5 years later, oh, it's worth nothing now because we've closed the pit.
And there's no reason for anyone being in this village.
Yeah.
Wow. So Thatcher's argument was that if a pit was uneconomic, there was no reason to keep a pit open and pay people to dig coal that was more expensive than the coal we imported from Poland. But of course, Thatcher wasn't putting into the equation unemployment benefit, the social cost of destroying whole communities. In fact, in the long run, of course, it cost us far, far more to have 3 million unemployed and the terrible sort of social deprivation that followed from the closure of all these pits. As the spring turned to summer, it became clear this miners' strike was not going to be sorted quickly. And there was, you know, you started to see the police being given extraordinary powers and abusing their powers, stopping people on the roads, stopping flying pickets on the road, but not stopping all sorts of people, people giving food support. And suddenly you had police with their numbers taken off their uniforms so that they couldn't be identified, being violent towards miners.
This is really massive, isn't it? Because this is the police doing the government's work, right, which is not their job.
I mean, for me as a 22-year-old student, it was a massively politicising year because I had never thought the police were institutionally corrupt or politically biased or anything like that. I mean, I would have thought individual soldiers was. And I'd read about things like the racism in the police and things like that. But to have the police actively supporting a government policy, exceeding their powers to do what Margaret Thatcher had requested of them, to be operating out of a national coordinating centre in London, which meant that we had a national police force, which is the, you know, what you have in fascist dictatorships.
Yes.
This was a great shock to me at the time, and in mining communities where they had been, you know, law-abiding citizens, it shattered the trust that those communities had had the police for generations, and that was never forgiven.
Yeah.
We spoke to some comedians, didn't we, Angela? We'll come on to that in a bit.
We will,
One of them was detained under the Prevention of Terrorism Act because he was flying in from Belfast where he'd done a gig, and he was going to Scotland to do a gig and support the miners. They knew he was going to a gig to support the miners, so they arrested him under the PTA.
They arrested him in Glasgow because they knew he was then... So he was flying from Belfast to Glasgow. This is Steve Gribbin, who was part of a double act called Skimp Video. And they'd performed in Belfast at a benefit, and then they were flying to Glasgow, and then they were travelling from Glasgow to do miners' benefits in Yorkshire, in Barnsley and Wakefield, I think it was. And the police detained them in Glasgow at the airport under the Prevention of Terrorism Act. They detained them for 6 hours, and that later said that it's because they knew they were going to be travelling to Yorkshire.
The atmosphere in the country was so sort of divided, and there was so much fake news, we'd say now, and so much lying about the miners and so much distortion of what was happening, that the police felt justified in breaking their own codes of conduct and exceeding their own powers to stop people on motorways for potentially committing civil offences, not criminal offences. But
there were blockades apparently at the Dartford Tunnel to stop pickets travelling to fields in Kent, where Kent had a huge amount of strikers. You know, most of the miners in Kent were on strike, and that, they would turn people back at the Dartford Tunnel.
MI5 were recording the phone conversations of miners' leaders. Stella Rimmington put this in her autobiography in years to come.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very, very scary time politically, in a time when we felt that the government were prepared to do anything beyond the sort of normal sort of exercise of democratic law. They would do anything outside that to beat the miners, close these pits and crush the unions, which was really the long-term agenda, I think.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned obviously that across the country there were different outcomes of the strike ballot, and in Nottinghamshire, Leicestershire, a lot of those Midlands areas where people voted not to strike. And I read a really interesting article, and it was only from last year, from 2019, but it was about a village in Nottinghamshire that was really split by this whole thing. There was a woman interviewed, her name was Yvonne Woodhead. Mm-hmm. She said that her husband decided to strike. He decided to join the miners across the UK and go in on strike. And she said that even now, 35 years later, people in that village ignore her if she says hello. She says, there are people here that will not go into a certain pub or certain shop because that's where the scabs went. People made up their minds in the first month of the strike and stuck to it. So she said, you had these communities where the whole community was behind the strike and supporting each other. But then you had these really divided communities as well. She said she remembers that during the strike, she borrowed some plastic cups from a local school for the strikers' children to use. And when she gave them back all washed and cleaned, the wives of the miners that were still working put them in the bin, wouldn't touch them. You know, and things like that. It's mad, isn't it?
It shows you the levels of anger that were at the
Absolutely.
Existing. There was a lot of anger in the striking areas about the what they call the scabs in Nottingham and Leicestershire. Mm-hmm. And as the strike went on, people's debt increased because the government had stopped miners taking unemployment benefit. They tried to stop them getting strike pay. So the poverty increased. And the hatred that miners felt towards those who betrayed them and the anger they felt, you know, often spilled over into violence on both sides. In the middle of all this was the miners' wives, who started out this 1984 as sort of housewives who made sure the home was clean and the children were smartly dressed before they went off to school. And at the end of the year had been sort of transformed in a sort of cathartic tragedy. Really.
I think in feminism, this is a real turning point, the miners' strike and what the miners' wives did. So like you say, to start with, they were traditional wives supporting their husbands, keeping their homes clean and looking after the kids while the husbands were down the mine, you know. And then what came out of this was, well, it started with a rally in Barnsley in May 1984. So we're 2 months into the strike.
Yes.
And 5,000 women from Scotland to Kent, from all over the country, that were wives of strikers, They came together under the banner of Women Against Pit Closures. And they organised a conference in June of that year and a large protest march in August where 23,000 working class women attended. But what this meant was that these were women that weren't politicised at all, you know, before this. They, like you say, they were homemakers. They were, yeah. And in fact, one of these women was Sian James, who ended up becoming a MP for Swansea for Labour in from 2005 to 2015. Yes. She was a Labour MP for Swansea.
That's right.
And she says herself, she says, like, at the beginning of the strike, she was, well, she got married at 16. She had two kids by the time she was 20. She says, as long as my lace curtains were the cleanest, my children immaculately dressed, their hand-knitted clothes made with love, I was happy. But she,
wow.
Yet this completely politicized her.
Yeah,
you know, she helped feed over 1,000 families a week from 9 different centers across Wales, the welfare centers. And after the strike, she took her A-levels, she went to Swansea University, got a degree, and then eventually she worked for Women's Aid for many years and then became an MP. So this is a woman who was not on that path.
Wow. And the strike made that started. Happen. So she was the one featured in, yeah, Pride, that movie Pride, about,
that's right,
the gays,
yes,
and lesbians supporting the miners. I actually saw her at one of the screenings of that film, and she was there, and she was like a sort of hero, you know, to have come, yeah, through that experience and to be, see herself portrayed on film like this was quite thrilling for her, I
bet.
But she's been made something of a hero on the left, you know.
But these women, you know, they were really, at the time, like you say, their benefits have been stopped. They weren't getting strike pay. They weren't, you know, so their main income was from these benefits that were raised. So the women were very involved in organising benefits and collections and things like that because their husbands were on the picket line. There was a lovely story that we had a little chat yesterday, like you mentioned, with some comedians that were doing benefits around that time. And Mark Steele, I think, said something really interesting, that he went to a rally in Mansfield, a rally where Scargill was speaking. And he said this was at the beginning of the strike, and it really illustrated how attitudes to women changed through the strike. He said at this rally, it was right at the beginning, and there was a woman speaker, and he described it as the worst caricature of 80s working class men. She came on the stage, they were shouting, "Get your tits out," wow, you know, and just were being vile and all, and it was awful. And, you know, these were, and at that time, the Yorkshire Minor magazine still had a page 3 girl.
Incredible.
In it, you know, that was the attitude to women. But he said by the end of the strike, in just a year,
yeah,
women were speaking at these rallies and getting respect from these men and getting, you know, because of what they'd done during,
yeah,
that process. And that's a huge thing for these large male working class communities to have a turnaround like that in the space of a year.
It is massive. And I think that the part of the positive to come out of the miners' strike is the education on both sides that occurred. I mentioned the film Pride just then. Mm-hmm. There was the support, gays and lesbians support the miners, which was the subject of that film. And, you know, those same miners who shouted, "Get your tits out," would not have been very well disposed towards gay men from London, you know, before they met any. But suddenly, no, when these miners were really, really up against it, police were sort of stopping them picketing, their benefits were being cut, and suddenly these gay political activists come up from London giving them support and money. They were very grateful to them and suddenly realised they were people just like them and they'd suffered persecution like the miners were suffering just now. And so that was an education to both sides. And I think, you know, one of the few good things to come out of the miners' strike.
Yeah. And if anyone listening hasn't watched the film Pride, as soon as you finish listening to this, go,
yes,
and watch it.
Yes.
It's incredible. But, you know, you will
I don't
cry.
Think Thatcher really ever anticipated quite how much public support there would be for the miners across the country. Even down in Devon, where I was a student, we would shake tins, we would donate money. And I was a member of the Labour Party. I'd just joined the year before. And the Labour Party became a real support network for the miners during that year. But the only time in its history, I think, the Labour Party has been more than just a political party. It was a whole support network. Every constituency was twinned with a pit. Somebody would come round and gather up food from your house, going through our larder, going, "Here's some baked beans. Here's some dog food," because your little miner's dog has got to have some food as well. I remember my dog donating some food to their dogs. And then, of course, there's the stuff like, Oh God, I'm never going to eat that anchovy paste. That's, so sorry.
It's like a Harvest Festival.
Sorry, Minor, whoever got the anchovy paste from Christmas 82, I'm embarrassed that you had that.
This is reminding me of a little story. Can I tell you a little, it's very little story, I recently really embarrassed myself in my local, this is when we were still allowed to go outside, and in my local Sainsbury's, like little Sainsbury's local, there's a homeless guy who's quite often sat outside, and I'll sort of, you know, ask him if he wants anything when I go in. And it's one day I said, I just went up to him and said, do you want anything? He said, no, I'm all right. And I said, because there was a dog sat next to him, I said, I'll get you some dog food.
Oh, no.
And he looked at me and it turned out not his dog. So it looked like I just got up to this homeless bloke and gone, I'll get you some dog food. Well, I had to go like, no, I thought it was your dog.
Oh, that's so terrible. I can't believe you thought that homeless people should eat dog food.
I felt terrible.
Yeah, well, my dog gave her dog food to the miners' dogs. I did a tiny bit of stand-up when I was at university and when I came to London. And then my second ever gig, went really badly. They stopped the disco and put me on. And all these bloody Sloan Rangers going, boo, get off. But I got paid 40 quid for that gig. And my only way of feeling good about it was to give the whole lot to the miners. And so when the bloke from the Labour Party came round, he went, 40 quid? I went, it's money from Sloan's.
Just don't
it's
ask.
Money from Sloan's. I want it to go to the miners. And
can I just say, that's 35 years ago, you were paid 40 quid for your second gig. You wouldn't get that now.
No, it was a university
like
summer 40 ball.
40 quid
you know,
for your second gig?
It was a university summer ball, so there's of money slopping around. It's true. This other thing I remember doing was there's some hippie said to me, sitting on a beanbag, taking too long to roll a joint. It was like, do you know about the 6 o'clock surge, man? What's the 6 o'clock surge? Ah, the government are suppressing it. But what you've got to do at 6 o'clock is turn on all your electrical units. Creates a real surge at the power station. It uses up much more coal than just, you know, the ordinary sort of thing. So come 6 o'clock, me and all my mates are going, right, turn on the yoghurt maker. that will bring down Thatcher.
That's activism.
That is, right, she's not going to stand that. So, yeah, the kettle, the electric hob, and the yogurt maker. So yeah, we would do what we could. And then there was this other thing, being in the Labour Party, because we were in Devon, they contacted Devon Labour parties and said, the miners' kids aren't going to get a holiday this year. So is there anyone who could put up a couple of children and take them to the beach and stuff like that? And we were like students going, yeah, we'll do that. We have kids, come stay with us. And,
Sending a load of kids to students.
We thought, we had this picture of these sort of sooty-faced evacuees coming with cloth caps from the north. And so we said, yeah, send them to us. So somebody came round, the coordinator from Exeter Labour Party, came to our house at like 11 in the morning. Ding dong. Oh, what's that doorbell? It's going so early
in
the morning.
We're all in bed.
We're all in bed. We answered the door with duvets wrapped around us. They looked around our front room with the Rizzlers piled up in the ashtray and the bloody washing up. And our pet chickens coming through the windows, eating all the bits of food off the plates. And the groggy couple was looking stoned and hungover. And they didn't think we were suitable.
Beggars can't be choosers, John, can they?
We didn't have a big enough garden.
That'll be it.
I reckon that's what it was.
I mean, you had chickens. What more do they want?
But that was the thing about the miners' strike. People so much wanted to help in any way they could. So I'd transfer my yellow Coal Not Dole sticker from one shirt to the next. You know, we'd all put money in the buckets or outside football grounds and outside pubs and all sorts of high streets. My sister got arrested in Maidenhead High Street just for shaking her
tin. In Maidenhead, really?
Yeah, in Maidenhead. It's like,
because
you can't
Middle England, actually, though, were quite behind the miners, right, generally. I think
lots of people were. It came down to your sort of politics in the end. But people wanted to do so much, and there was a huge amount of support for the miners. Let's take a short break there and grab a jar of anchovy paste or some dog food, and we'll see you after the break.
Does what's going on in the American election scare and bemuse you in equal measure?
Want to know what Biden and Trump are up to without tearing your hair out?
Then you need to listen to American Friction, the brand new podcast about the countdown to the big vote in November from the makers of Oh God, What Now?, The Bunker and Paper Cuts.
Every Friday, we'll speak to leading experts and blockbuster commentators from the United States to explain the latest news and the big issues behind the vote.
That's American Friction with me, Jacob Jarvis.
Me, Chris Jones.
And me, Nikki McCann Ramirez.
Out every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hold up.
Two Wheel History. We're talking about the miners' strike. Now, John, you mentioned earlier that there was a lot of wider support in the community. We talked about gays and lesbians supporting the miners and stuff. But I think it's worth a little honourable mention, seeing as we both work in comedy, to talk about what was going on with a sort of alternative cabaret scene, as it was in the 80s. This is a sort of scene, it's people that weren't on telly yet. So there's people you'd have heard of now, your Mark Steels and Mark Thomas and people like that. But at this point, they were on the alternative cabaret circuit. So on the TV, you still had Jim Davison.
Yes.
You know, but you had these radical performers doing circus, cabaret, poetry, all sorts of things. And obviously, a lot of them were affiliated with the Labour Party, were left-wingers. Yeah. And supported the miners. So they would put on these benefits across the country in order to raise money for them. And they would go to mining communities as well and put on shows to raise money for the miners. And then they would put on shows at like the Hackney Empire and places like that.
Northeast London Polytechnic. Money. I sent you a I sent you a little poster. Poster, didn't I?
Yeah,
I'll tweet out that poster. That's from 1985, but it's incredible to look at the names on that. And you know, Ben Elton was on there, and
Rick Mayall did a lot of benefits.
Yeah, Arthur Smith,
lots
and,
of
household John Higley.
Names, absolutely. And I work quite a lot with people like Mark Steele and Steve Gribbin, who we talked about earlier, who was part of Skint Video. And I love hearing their stories of this time, because you've got these kind of airy fairy lefty performers from the mostly from the southeast of England, you know, going into these mining communities in Merthyr Tydfil or in, you know, Wakefield or Sheffield or wherever, and bringing this weird cabaret to an audience that are still watching the comedians on TV, you know, still watching your Jim Davisons and your, and it's such a lovely sort of clash of culture, just such a positive one as well. And I love that Mark Steele, we talked to yesterday, and he said, you know, dying on your ass in front of these people was the worst kind of dying on your ass, because they wanted to like you. They were really grateful that you'd come to perform for them.
It's not
they
like
were
me
like
dying in front of a load of Sloan Rangers. It's
no, like, no. It's like, these people were like, I really want to laugh at you, but I just don't know what you're doing.
It's like, because you had all the thing about the circuit back then in its early days, it was so experimental and sort of, you know, you'd have a comedian and then you'd have someone putting a banger up their bum and then you'd have someone doing kabuki mime or something.
Yeah, and we had Andre Vincent, who was one of these comedians, was telling us, wasn't he, about there was an act called The Iceman, and his whole act was just melting ice, basically. And he's like, he's trying to do that in front of a load of miners who just go, what's this?
What the hell?
What's he doing? Or there's Andrew Bailey, who they said, I can't remember what his stage name was, but he used to just hit Weetabix into the crowd with a tennis racket. It's like, and things
great,
like
great
that.
Comedy. Great comedy. And what Mark Steele was saying was that you just, at no other time since then could it happen like that. The gap, the gulf between a pit village in Yorkshire and the alternative cabaret circuit was so huge.
Yeah.
You know, in subsequent years, you'd have those guys would be on TV and there'd be Channel 4.
Well, he said, you know, in the early 90s, they were doing similar things for the Liverpool Dockers.
Yes.
But they were, the Liverpool Dockers by that point were sort of comedy literate. They'd watched this stuff on TV. They'd seen, you know, Comic Strip Presents or whatever. And they got this kind of humour. But
absolutely.
In the mid-80s, this was... must have just been alien.
But then sometimes there'd be a gig in London, a benefit, and then the miners would come and stay. A couple of miners would come and stay with on the couch, and then, you know, there'd be some student union at Cambridge or, you know, Durham or somewhere, and the miners were going to stay there, and some, you know, the young female students would think, I'm going to sleep with a miner, you know. And so there were various affairs that were had.
It was all very pulp common people, wasn't it? It's like, I'm going to sleep with a miner.
And a few
and
marriages.
That's the thing, is it? A lot of the miners, were sort of getting off with radical students.
It's like,
why not?
But, I mean, not only were their wives becoming politicised, but, you know, the miners were having affairs. And after the miners' strike, one of the sad consequences was there was just no going back to what things were before, because those wives you talked about were not going to go back to the kitchen and having clean pressed white shirts for their little children and dinner on the table when they came back from the pit in exactly the same way. Yeah. What was it they called them? The pudding burners.
The pudding burners, yeah, because oh, that's true. I forgot about that. I didn't mention that we were talking about women, but yeah, because often at the welfare miners' welfare clubs, these sort of get-togethers would happen on a Sunday. These talks would happen, and because women were coming to them, they weren't at home cooking the Sunday lunch, so the local miners started calling them the pudding burners, the women that were active. There was a lovely story we were told yesterday by Steve Gribbin and Andy Smart, who were both entertainers at this time. And they did a benefit at Willesden Junction Power Station at 7 a.m.
Oh
on
God.
A December morning and the coldest day of the year and, you know, trying to entertain the picketers. And by all accounts, a lot of the people we spoke to said one of the performers that was most successful at these gigs was Jeremy Hardy. They said, you know, it was often very difficult because you have, you know,
follow Scargill.
Exactly. You had these political speakers and then now for some comedy. And they said that Jeremy Hardy was the only person really who could follow someone like Scargill. And at this power station gig at 7 o'clock in the morning, apparently he opened his set by saying, you know, good morning, comrades. I just want to make it clear that this gig contravenes equity temperature regulations. Which
oh, dear. Yeah, I mean, there was a real network of comedians and musicians organised by Apples and Snakes and Alternative Arts.
Yeah,
and Cast
New Varieties. Yeah.
Even after the strike was over, they were doing benefits to pay a mortgage, pay them a pay a fine. And help them get legal advice because so many miners have been arrested and unfairly arrested.
And there's sort of a direct line between this towards the Red Wedge movement
that came later.
And I think this is, I mean, we, you know, there's so much we could do entire podcasts on here. And I think at some point in the future, we probably will do one.
Get them on board. Get them on
board
with us.
Yeah, because the chat we had with them yesterday was so brilliant and we just haven't got time to do it.
Don't make it
in this
sound
podcast.
More interesting than this, Angela.
Yeah, should have just recorded that and put that out. But we will do an episode on that because it's so fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right with Ben Elton and Billy Bragg and all these people who later helped Red Wedge. They had been supporting the miners in the couple of years beforehand and had the idea of, you know, political comedy. And it brought it to a wider audience, you know. It brought people to gigs and students and people in London and non-mining areas to think about what was happening with the miners and to hear from a miner, give a speech, what they were trying to do. So when the miner strike first happened, I was in Stirling University, with where my girlfriend was, and I was staying there. And they had a student meeting, and these two miners came to spoke to us. And that's the first I heard of the miners' strike, was these two blokes in their full miners' gear talking to all our students. And we were going, blimey, okay, that's pretty serious. They're going to close all the mines. And that was, you know, to hear it firsthand from someone was very powerful testimony, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, because the media wasn't reporting the miners'
we didn't
have Twitter and Facebook and things to sort of,
I mean, the media were not only, you know, misrepresenting the miners, they were behaving appallingly. As you said, the Sun had a picture
the
of...
The Sun was behaving appallingly?
You know that
you
story
sure?
I was going to do. It had one front page, infamous front page, when Arthur Scargill had been directing pickets when he was trying to stop the lorries going at Orgreave, and he was waving his arm around, but they caught it at a vertical angle as if he was giving a Nazi salute.
Yeah.
And said, the headline was Mein Führer, and he said it was Arthur Scargill.
Was it Sieg Heil, wasn't it?
Sieg Heil or something like that.
Yeah. And the print workers refused to print it, right?
Exactly, yeah. So the Sun had a black page that day.
Yeah.
And when people marched down Fleet Street, some of the people who worked at the Sun had a banner out the window saying, we work for the lie machine. Then that's how they even there felt how distorting and dishonest it was. But even the BBC, when they showed the footage of the infamous Orgreave, what's been called the Battle of Orgreave in the summer of 84, when police charged on cavalry, on horseback, they charged into lines of peaceful miners with their truncheons drawn, beating those miners to the ground. And then later the miners, blooded and, you know, in trainers and T-shirts, started to throw stones and bricks, half bricks and stuff, so that, or punch the police. The BBC reversed the footage when they showed it on the news that night. It was so unpalatable to the British people to say this is how the police are behaving that they showed the miners as the provocateurs and the police responding with a cavalry charge. Now, that was shocking to me as a middle-class English boy to see the BBC, I don't know if the BBC...
How did it come out that the BBC had done that?
Because there are other journalists there who'd seen things in that order. So it wouldn't be like a slow version of Twitter. It was people, you know, Guardian journalists or writers going, I was there. It didn't happen that way around, guys.
Right, yeah.
And people were also filming their own, you know, other news agencies from around the world were there, of course. I don't think the BBC were taking calls from Margaret Thatcher and saying, let's swap the footage around. I think someone inside the BBC was going, oh, this feels right. This feels more right, you know, that the police wouldn't do that. But the police were doing that, and the truth, you know, needed to be reported.
You see, this is where the spreading of disinformation, people think it's a new thing, that's this fake news, but it's just happened forever.
Yeah, I mean, Orgreave, we should talk a little bit about Orgreave. Orgreave was sort of the worst incident in the whole thing, and these police charges of miners and then the miners fighting back was a very ugly and terrifying, really, scene in sort of British post-war history. To have thousands of miners trying to close a coking plant.
Yeah,
and to have thousands of police on horseback charging them, it was a terrifying scene. But the police behaved with excessive brutality.
Is this South Yorkshire police?
I think it was all over. I think they had police from all over. That's the other thing about this. You had the Met coming up, waving their £10 notes at rows of striking
they
miners.
They did, didn't they?
I think someone even said they burned notes. I'm not sure whether they're burning them or waving them, but they were flaunting how much money they were making out of the strike to the miners.
And they were starving.
They were, yes. And they were grabbing miners any old way and hitting them with truncheons and then arresting them for assault. And this was very common. There's footage of miners being thrown at the back of vans and having truncheons rain down on them. And then those miners would be charged with assault and charged, and the judge would uphold these charges because the police don't lie. And they'd have, you know, the police would agree on the evidence they were going to give and then read it out in court. And those guys had a criminal record. So this was a big shock to someone like me or my parents that the police were behaving like this. And we lived in such a, what was becoming a sort of an undemocratic state, really.
Yeah,
That people were striking to save other people's jobs and their own jobs and their kids' jobs. And yet were being beaten, charged with offences they hadn't committed. And the BBC was prepared to reverse the footage. And the judges were prepared to stretch and bend the law to make sure that the miners' funds were sequestrated and that they had no access to the money that they'd paid into their own strike funds. It was the first time in my life that I really thought, oh, the establishment are prepared to do anything, however undemocratic and unjust or totalitarian, to stop this working class movement achieving its goals. Now, that's not to say that, you know, there weren't violent miners and that the tactic of trying to stop people going to work with mass picketing, you know, is not questionable in itself.
Well, the whole scab label that was given to... And Steve Gribbin, again, one of the comedians talked about that pirate radio station that was set up called Radio Scab that would just read out the list of miners that were going to work.
But the whole mood in the country was these miners are terrible. You know, they're terrible. They're violent. And you weren't allowed to speak unless you condemned violence. It was like, hello, we're going to do the weather in your local area now. And I will say I do condemn violence. You know, you couldn't talk about the miner strike without saying you condemn violence. And the implication was the miners' violence.
Yeah.
I remember on Wogan, they had Jackie Charlton, the footballer and football manager, was on Wogan.
Is he from the northeast? Look at me, I know nothing about
him. Yeah, he was up from Chester Street or somewhere like that, Newcastle. And Wogan said to him, so what would you have done if you hadn't been a footballer? And Jackie Charlton went, well, I would have gone down pit. Me and Bobby would have both been miners. And he said, and would you be on strike now, though? Yes, of course I'd be on strike. Those lads are striking for their jobs in their communities. And Wogan was like nearly falling off the back of his chair. I thought, yay, Jackie Charlton's a hero. Jackie Charlton's one of us.
Yeah.
And then he goes, what about the fishing and the hunting you like to do? Some people don't like that. Oh, you get these nutters on the left who don't like that. No! he just split the left down the middle. But, you know, what I remembered from that was Wogan's tone was very much, surely you wouldn't be joining Arthur Scargill's strike, you know. And it was surprising to see Jackie Charlton assert their right to strike. So
yeah,
strongly.
Because the strong rhetoric from the government, from the media, was the... Well, Thatcher made that speech, didn't she? In which she said, Galtieri and the Argentinians were the enemy without. Arthur Scargill and the miners are the enemy within. And that is huge thing for a prime minister to say.
To say, you know, about your huge industry that had sustained Britain's sort of power stations for a century. And they were the enemy within. So in that climate that gave the police permission to behave like that and to arrest people for shaking tins or to charge Steve Gribben under the Prevention of Terrorism Act.
Presumably they would treat it, because obviously this is mid-80s where, you know, the Cold War as well, you've got anti-communist feeling and there's a lot of sort of aligning the miners to communists, right? You know, there's that rhetoric of being, well, if we let them get away with this, then... then the doors open for communism, right?
Yes. And, you know, the violence did bring deaths. There were there were miners who fell under lorries crossing picket lines, who were in the shove and the push, were crushed under lorries. There were children who were killed when they were scavenging for coal and the coal slipped on them. And then there was a working miner who was killed when two strikers dropped a slab of concrete on the taxi taking him to work. I will say that one got 10 times more media coverage than the other deaths because of, you know, it was a murder, I suppose. So you could argue that that was sort of more justified, that the brutality of dropping a concrete slab on a passing car, you know, was a huge story. But the other deaths hardly got a mention during the strike.
I think there were five deaths in total.
I think that
miners,
doesn't even include
right?
the kids, actually.
Yeah, so that's just of miners.
Yeah, yeah. So the striking miners and the non-striking miners were so divided that in the end, a separate union was formed in the Nottinghamshire area, with quite a lot of encouragement from the Daily Mail, with a mystery figure called Silver Birch. But the Union of Democratic Miners in Nottinghamshire eventually was formed, and they were the union for the miners who carried on working.
Hello, I'm Dorian Linsky.
And I'm Ian Dunn.
We are the hosts of Origin Story, the podcast that unpacks the history behind the ideas, the people and the events that shape political discourse today.
And we are back for season 5.
We're kicking off with a two-parter on George Orwell, the man, the work, the ideas. We follow him from Burma to Spain, through Second World War London, to the writing of his masterpieces Animal Farm and 1984, and how their legacy is used and misused today.
That's Origin Story Season 5, coming now from anywhere you get your podcasts.
But for a year, incredible solidarity. No one thought that the miners would hold on for so long, but there were divisions within families, within communities. But gradually, debt and fear and hunger forced some miners back. Mm-hmm. And people would cry as they walked back. Miners would cry as they walked back to work in the winter of 1984-5. And many of them were not forgiven. And many of them were outcasts in their own family for going back to work, you know, before the official return.
And even after the official return, some strikers stayed out, right? Some, yes, I know in Kent, where I'm from, the Kent NUM organised a continuation of picketing across the county and delayed the return to work for about 2 weeks. So.
That's right. Christmas was really tough for the miners. The kids had no presents. They had no Christmas lunch. We were in the Labour Party. We're sending what we could, but you can only do so much for that many people. People were selling furniture. I remember a BBC reporter going up to a little child, you know, in one of the pit villages and going, "Do you think you're going to have a very nice Christmas?" And she went, "No." Oh. He goes, "Do you wish your daddy would go back to work?" And she went, "Yes."
Oh.
And it's like, God, it was so leading, the question.
That's,
you know, it's
to do that
I'd love
to
track
child.
That reporter down now.
And that child. And just, how did you feel about now about being used like that?
Yeah. Oh, it's shocking. And that was normal. That was par for the course, you know. The courts had ruled the strike illegal in September. Then early, I think, November, the government announced, Peter Walker was the energy minister. He announced that there would be no power cuts this winter. And that was such a blow for the miners to think, oh, God, we're going to have to go a whole extra year. And by February, it was pretty clear the strike was lost. And in early March, I think 3rd of March 1985, the miners voted at a special conference to return to work. That was huge news. It was a Sunday morning. I was sitting at home watching the telly for a live broadcast to see the news. So I knew this thing was happening. Mm. And BBC Sunday morning was showing Dad's Army. And they just had a little caption across the screen, just come up, newsflash, miners vote to return to work. And the sitcom just carried on playing. And it was just like, sitcom, the canned laughter carried on laughing, and Captain Mannering and Private Pike carried on having their antics. And it felt like that was so tragic after a year of the strike to have it just all over and Thatcher won.
And that's such a long time for a strike to be.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
and so they marched back behind banners with brass bands and the wives handing a red carnation to every miner who had stayed out for a year.
Wow.
And Scargill, in fact, was a part of the march back, but the Kent strikers that you talked about formed a picket line, said we're not going back to work, and he wouldn't cross the picket line.
So he couldn't march back. He couldn't march back.
Yeah. Kinnock called it a year lost in the fight against Thatcher. He was detested by the miners for not being more strong. They hated the TUC for not causing a general strike. Yeah. Kinnock was, of course, the new leader of the Labour Party, the son of a miner himself. It took him till January to stand on a picket line, to be seen on a picket line.
That's getting on for a year.
Yes, and you couldn't look more awkward than Neil Kinnock standing on a picket line during the miners' strike. I got one book, which is a completely Trotskyist tract, which said he was taken there in a chauffeur-driven car. It's like, well, he was the leader of the opposition. He gets a car.
Yeah. Probably quite a target otherwise.
He detested Scargill and Scargill detested him, and I don't think that was a big secret at the time. But, you know, 26 million working days were lost to the dispute. In 1983, there had been, the year before the strike, there had been 174 working pits. By 2009, there were only six.
Wow.
And that shows you what the scale of what happened to the coal industry in this country.
Absolutely.
I'm not saying that you keep every mine open, but if you're a compassionate government, a government that's interested in your whole country, if you do close down mines, you have a plan for that community, and you say, well, maybe we'll put our call centres there, or maybe we'll get some investment from abroad to build a factory there or whatever. You don't just put hundreds of thousands of people out.
Entire communities in. Yeah.
Yeah. And Steve Gribben was saying he went back to one of those places 10 years later, and he saw someone, just a kid, shooting up heroin in a bus shelter.
And that's the thing, isn't it? It's a direct line, I think, from the miners' strike to what happened with Brexit, really, that a lot of those communities voted for Brexit because they'd been decimated. And the Remain campaign for Brexit focused so much on the economy. And it's like, well, if you've had 30 years with fuck all, what does the economy matter to you? Nothing, you know.
If David Cameron is saying, oh, your high street will close, hey, come and look at the boarded up
what
shops
high
in,
street?
Our, in our town.
Exactly.
Yeah. Many of those places never recovered, and there was never the investment or the jobs for people after that. The union movement in Britain was really broken in that strike, and subsequent strikes, you know, just didn't get the traction that they might have done because people just didn't feel that they could beat, that they would beat Thatcher. And the power of employers to sack workers, every 0 hours contract today, every bit of the gig economy, every Amazon worker who is sacked for speaking out about conditions, you know, every non-unionized workforce, there's a direct line from the miners' strike and the defeat of the miners to where the economy and the power of workers is today.
Yeah.
I think that was what was so important about it.
It was the first huge loss for the unions and that sort of sense of, well, what's the point then? Isn't it, I suppose, amongst workers? Then, what's the point in joining my union if they can't win?
Yeah. I mean, back then it felt like a lost war, really.
Yeah.
It felt like a brutal assault on working people by sort of vicious Tory government, hell-bent on revenge and suppressing union power. And that's really what it was about. It was about suppressing union power, not about closing mines. And yet now, you know, we look at coal and we think, we don't want to, you know, we don't want to be burning coal.
This is the interesting thing, isn't it? Because actually now with the, you know, Extinction Rebellion and the Green Movement and everything else, coal is the enemy, right?
I know. Trump is the one advocating coal
right?
now.
It's
a right wing saying, oh, go back to coal. But back then that wasn't part of the debate at all.
No.
The only one was, we're talking to these comics again yesterday, they're saying Tony Allen was the only one who
refused to perform,
saying, I'm not
didn't
supporting
he?
The miners because we shouldn't be burning coal. He was like a sort of,
but he was a real outlier ecology. Like you say, the Green Party wasn't really a thing then. I remember the first time I heard about sort of acid rain being a thing and greenhouse gases and all that wasn't until the late 80s. At this point in 1984-85, no one was talking about the environment. No one was talking about...
No, they weren't even the Green Party. They were the Ecology Party.
Right,
They got seven votes.
So,
Now we would say, you know, coal isn't the answer, but we still would argue that if you're going to put hundreds of thousands of people out of work, you have to have a plan.
It's got to be a contingency.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing I'd say about all this is that it's another one. We were talking about the Spanish Civil War the other week about, you know, that the story being written by the losers. Mm. I think that's true of the miners' strike as well, really. The culture and the stories of the miners' strike is about them. Nobody's written a moving drama about the police paying off their mortgages with all the overtime.
Yeah, that's right. You know, there's no film, is there?
We get.
About I was a policeman in the miners' strike.
I mean, the only one I'd say is Thatcher, I suppose, the Iron Lady film shows her being tough to Scargill. Mm. But generally, the stories like Billy Elliot, Brastoff, Pride.
Yeah.
These are stories from the striking communities that make heroes out of the strikers who are striking for jobs, not for money.
Yeah.
There's some great fiction and
art, theatre, all sorts of stuff that, yeah, absolutely.
Came out of it.
Absolutely.
GB84 by David Peace is worth a read. Billy Elliot is great, of course, film and musical. The musical is surprisingly political, actually. They have a whole row of sort of policeman's shield and truncheons and stuff. It's pretty scary.
Oh, wow, I've not seen the musical.
More political than the film, I'd say.
Wow.
Brastoff, I went to see Brastoff at the National Theatre. And because they did a dramatization of the film,
right?
And it was great with brass bands and everything. And as I was leaving, this woman behind me, I heard me and Jackie were leaving, and the woman behind, we heard her say, "Well, of course, you know, these miners all got huge payoffs. Many of them bought second homes."
What?
I wanted to turn around and scream in her face.
What are you
I don't know what
about?
Paper she's reading, the Daily Telegraph or something.
Who paid them off? True, you know?
Yeah, I know. It's insane.
Amazing.
And also, you mentioned comic strip earlier. Mm. There was a great episode. The best episode of the comic strip ever was Strike, I think. They did this sort of parody. Hollywood does the miners' strike with Arthur Scarface and the Hollywood executive saying, wait, are you telling me that the miners lose? No, rewrite it. And then, and I think it's Alexis Sale is the script writer. And I think Nigel Planer is the executive going, in British trade union history, it is quite important that the miners lose. It's like, I don't care about that. The miners win. It's worth watching if you can never get it out on video. But looking back now,
I've not seen it. In fact, I've got all the comic strips and I just haven't watched them all yet.
Oh, watch Strike. It's great.
Yeah, I will.
It's really great. But now it's like it's like a tragic story from another age of an industrial Britain, of a unionised post-war Britain. It's sort of the end of that era, really.
Mm. And it's sort of the end of that kind of identity of working class communities, isn't it, really?
I think so, yeah. I mean, to be in a union in a place like Yorkshire or Lancashire, you know, you were part of something. I've talked about without being too cliched about it, but brass bands and working men's clubs.
It wasn't just about work, was it? It was your social life as well. You had the welfare hall where you would have your gatherings and parties and whatever and, you know, and speeches and things. And it was, like you say, part of the community.
You don't get many brass bands at call centre, do you? Let's be honest. So, I think to do with identity and people saying, well, I was a miner, I was a member of the union, and I'm a Yorkshireman. Mm. Those are things that, you know, that gave people a sense of who they were. And those, I think, have been taken away from a lot of people in this country. And I think that was, you know, Brexit was one of the symptoms of
absolutely.
That as well. That working class people have been made to feel bad about being working class.
You had to be aspirational. You had to want to be middle class.
You had to be middle class. And I think the Labour government of the 90s and noughties can take some responsibility
absolutely.
For that as well, trying to middle classify people.
Yeah.
The miners and the steel workers and the dockers and the railwomen were working class union men and proud of it. And, you know, that was something that Thatcher hated and was determined to destroy. On that happy note...
yes. I'm just going to go and have a little cry.
I'm going to tell you now, I was against Maggie. I may not have come across...
Well, it may not I'm have glad you clarified that, John, because it's been worrying me about where you stood on Maggie Thatcher.
I think we've done both sides of the miners' strike.
This is a very balanced episode, you know.
Yeah.
Luckily, this isn't the BBC.
Yes, quite. We could never do this on Radio 4, let's be honest. But I'm sure people will think that, you know, we've left things out. There's so much to say about it. Surprisingly few good books about it, I would say.
There yeah, because we really tried to find...
There's not one big definitive miners' strike tome. There's like Seamus Milne has done one about the special operations against them. And then there's all sorts of books by sort of a mad Socialist Workers' Party members.
There's quite a lot of sort of academic things as well. There's a little shout out to my pal Katie Shaw, who's written a brilliant book on the sort of cultural... outcomes really of the miners' strike and how it leads, you know, it's a direct line. And she's actually really interestingly talking a lot at the moment about the coronavirus situation we're in as a parallel to what happened there and the sort of cultural right. shift that will come out of that. So look up okay. her. She's written a lot of stuff for New Statesman and things. So look her up, yeah. Katie Shaw.
Very interesting. But the miners' strike, 1984 to 85, the end of unionised Britain, the death of the old-fashioned labour movement, the moment that we learned that the British establishment would do whatever was necessary to protect the middle classes against the working classes, really. If I don't sound like too much of a trot, I'm really quite soft left Labour, but it was a radicalising time for me.
John the Trot, that's what they call him.
Next time, if we've not been put in prison and charged with the Prevention of Terrorism Act, we'll catch you next time on We Are History. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening.